Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 67, recorded on May 8th of 2019, the podcast where we geek out about photography and technology as it relates to photography and science and law and everything as it all boils down to that photographic substance that we have in our veins. And I know somebody has been on the show a number of times and has a fairly educated background on photography, but on business and on a good many things. Works at owns a modeling agency, loves film photography, and recently did a cross-country bike trek. Yeah. Welcome to the podcast here, Steve Brokaw.
Hey, Don. How you doing? Hello, everybody.
Very good. Very good. And Steve, I love to have you on periodically, especially when I've got topics that I know you've got an educated opinion on. Right. So it's great that the timing worked out well for the stuff that we're going to talk about. But the timing's also great because you just came back from a grand adventure.
Right.
And you were taking some snaps along the way. It wasn't a photographic journey mm-hmm. by any means. It was more of a cultural pilgrimage and athletic activity.
Right.
Just to kind of say that you did it, to go from one coast to the other coast. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I just got back last week from a cross USA bike trip. So not bike, motorcycle, but bicycle. So I started in St. Augustine, Florida, and rode over the course of 55 days to San Diego, California. So I went across 8 states and had an amazing time. It was, it was a bucket list item for me that I've wanted to do for years. And finally, the right time came upon me, and I trained for a year. And I think we talked about it the last time I was on the show, and I just got back. So it was an amazing time.
So what kind of stands out for you in terms of, I mean, clearly you brought cameras along with you. I know you had some film cameras and I'm sure some digital snaps as well. So photography was a component in that.
Right.
But was there anything specific that you wanted to document? Was it just the narratives at large?
Yeah, I didn't want to make the social media or the photography the main focus of it. I wanted to really just go out there and ride, and the photography and posting online was kind of a secondary thing that I wanted to do. But I really wanted to capture images and photos that I could look back 5-10 years from now and kind of bring a smile to my face and, oh yeah, I remember that. And also just to document how diverse countries like the US and Canada are, that, you know, you could be in one state like Florida and then go to New Mexico and it's 100% different, both people, the landscape, the weather, no different than if you're in Ottawa versus Alberta and Calgary. You know, it's going to get a different look. So I did that, and it's amazing just to go back and look at to see how things were totally different. So I wanted to document the differences too.
It's kind of the journey that even if you got home and for whatever reason, your film couldn't be developed or mm-hmm. your memory cards were wiped out, you'd still be a better person for making the journey. And so the photography becomes secondary to that, mm-hmm. but helps you along the way. And you're right about diversity. The United States has been quite greatly divided, I think, mm-hmm. for many years before I was born. And and that still continues today. But look at other countries. Look at Europe.
Right.
Okay. If you biked that same distance,
right.
how many countries would you have visited, right?
Right. I looked at I'm going to be doing this again, hopefully. and I looked at an opportunity to go over to Europe. So the idea was I was going to go to Manchester in the UK, bike up to Scotland, go to the east, go along the east coast of the UK, drop down to to France, go to Paris, and then up to Holland, and then around down, and then go into Russia, into St. Petersburg. So that seems like a long trek, but that was actually a lot shorter, by about 500 miles shorter than the trek I was just on. So the trek that I did was 3,000 miles, and the one that I looked at was shorter than that. So it's just a scale issue.
Yeah, well, we are still governed by our geography mm-hmm. To certain degrees. I mean, if you have, my wife is from Bulgaria, mm-hmm. and they'll have some more remote villages in the mountains that have such a different dialect of the language that you wouldn't be able to understand them if you were from outside of that particular area. And that's changing with the global village mentality that we have now, where everybody's connected. But then those remote villages that would have, obscure or maybe extreme ideas, celebrations, traditions that are right. much different than the rest of the world, then they now might have to defend them. And right. there could be, different kinds of conflicts. So the world is an ever-changing place. But to see that sort of in your own backyard, as it were, across your own country, I think it's valuable. And I'm sure once I see more of the images that you've taken, that some of that will come through.
Yeah, I took tons of images and I took a lot of film and I haven't developed a single roll yet. And I've got it sitting back in the table back here. And I developed my own film. So I'm going to have to spend that over probably the summer doing that. But I think the key issue on this, whether it's for a photography event or for charity or whatever you do something like this, what you find is that even though we're a global society, everybody's connected, you go to small towns and it looks literally like time passed them by. And yeah. a lot of people, they'll drive on an interstate or they'll drive on a major road or they'll fly from one place to another. But when you do something, whether you're walking or hiking or stop along the way or biking, you see these small little towns and it's amazing. It's like time stopped.
That's my favorite part of traveling is mm-hmm. going to these non-travel destination locations, mm-hmm. right? Where there might be some tourists to some degree. I mean, it's hard to find a place on the planet without them these days.
Right.
But it's not what their economy is based on. And
exactly.
the people are just living their lives. And especially in, old world areas like, across Europe, it's right. an even greater experience because you can see these farm villages that, these buildings are what, 300-400 years old.
Easily.
And, you still have somebody that's, hanging out the laundry on the street side and that kind of character, that quality, I think is, it's not going to last forever.
Right.
Because that once that generation goes and the generation underneath them is that connected generation, mm-hmm. Then the traditional values will, I think, fairly quickly fade away within a right. generation or two.
Yeah, it was a totally enjoyable experience. But one thing that came to mind, and it's very relevant to what we talk about most of the time, is that if you want to do something, whether it's create a book or, pick up film photography or do something monumental, do it. I mean, don't wait till the perfect time. You just have to do it because you're going to wake up one day and say, I could have written a book and it was going to take a long time to do, but I didn't do it because I was busy doing something else. So one of the things that I did, I just set a marker in my calendar and said, I'm going to do it by this date. And I did. So I can always look back on that and say, I did it. So I really enjoyed it.
And if you wanted to go out and shoot film, for whatever that experience is to you today, there's new ways that you can do that if we want to segue into the news stories. I'm not even sure where to start with this first one. The Yashica brand has been dragged through the mud quite
Absolutely.
A bit lately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a company. The brand is owned by I think it's a holding company of some sort. Mm-hmm. They have had some interesting failures. And I say interesting because, they definitely got our attention with the Yashica Y35 camera
right.
That was massively overfunded on Kickstarter for crowdfunding. And it turned out to be the cheapest piece of garbage you could
right.
imagine. So bad that I actually want one because it's so bad. It's like people in 10 years from now will be using that instead of, finding a social media article with photos from a Game Boy camera, right?
Right, right.
It's going to be that bad. But they're going back to the film roots with mm-hmm. the Yashica brand right now and reported widely, but this is a Petapixel article that says Yashica unveils 3 35mm cameras and 2 new films. Arguably, I think the film idea is pretty hard to screw up
mm-hmm.
because all you would have to do is go to somebody already manufacturing film, buy some of that film stock, roll it into your own canisters with your own labels on it, and away you go.
Right.
So there's two varieties. And I honestly don't think that they're going to be creating their own brand new emulsions from this based on their track record. It just seems to me like that's
right.
going to be, maybe it'll happen later, but there's no evidence one way or the other. It's just my kind of personal feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 film cameras that, okay, if you could have like, I don't know, the cheaper and the actually a camera that I might want to shoot with, but I don't think it'll ever be. The first one looks like the drugstore disposable camera that you might still find sitting expired and forlorn behind a drugstore counter. And this is what they're going to be calling their MF1. And it goes on from there. But I want you to jump in, Steve, because your opinions on film are valuable to me.
Right.
Do you think this is going to be of any interest to people, like, once bitten, twice shy kind of thing?
Yeah, I think for the informed film photographers, the whole Digifilm thing that came out a couple of years ago was a complete disaster. I mean, it was massively overfunded. The camera, like you said, was not good. It was useless. There was a lot of articles in the paper, in the press about how people were very upset with it. So it set a very bad tone going forward. The film, it's always nice. Don't get me wrong. It's always nice to have new film stock. But my impression is that, like you said, this is not new emulsion. This is probably just either re-spooled film or they've purchased excess stock sitting someplace. But this is just standard 400 film. So unless somebody like Fujifilm or Kodak made it for them or Rolly, then I doubt if it's new stock. It may be, but we'll have to see. So it's always good. So I can't criticize that. But you know, something has to say, why would you buy that versus buying Kodak film or buying Revlog film or some established film stock out there? But again,
I had seen somebody in the comments basically say, you know, that they have a limited edition film stock as well that they're calling the Golden 80s. Mm-hmm. And somebody said that looks identical to Kodak Gold.
Right.
I mean, if you knew that film and you looked at that, and I've got a bunch of it, you know, in a shoebox somewhere from back in the day, that's exactly what it looks and feels like.
My guess, it's probably going to be re-spooled film. But the cameras themselves, the first camera, like you said, it's a joke. It's a little point and shoot that's very cheap, very plasticky.
They don't have to design that. They just have to go out to the designs already made.
Right.
And I'm sure somebody even on Alibaba is selling these shells at, 50 cents a unit when you buy 1,000 of them.
And the thing that worries me about something like this is that if you're trying to attract new film photographers, somebody that gets into the genre, you want to give them a good experience. But if you give them a cheap camera that takes terrible pictures, that breaks after two uses, then that gives a bad impression of the industry. So, if you want a cheap camera like that, go to your local, mass market store and buy a disposable camera and shoot away. But I saw that one. I thought, no, this is a joke. The second camera, which was
the MF2.
My guess is that there's probably thousands of those sitting in a warehouse someplace that were never sold, and they're just going to put them back out. Unless they make a brand new one. I mean, that camera back then was an inexpensive camera. It was a point and shoot, nothing special. It was an upgraded camera versus, the little point and shoots. But, I think those cameras were rebranded and sold by other companies too. So I'm not sure what it has to offer. A little bit more robust, but my guess is that they're probably stock that's sitting in some warehouse in Hong Kong someplace. The third camera is the one that has the potential, but it also scares me the most because
me too.
The Yashica 44, the problem is that photo that they used for their Kickstarter is an actual Yashica 44. And, I know our guests can't see it, but I have one right here. And this is a robust little camera. I think it used 126 film or 126 film. And it's a cult camera today. And a lot of people do hacks to put 35 millimeter film in it. Well, are they going to make a new metal Yashica 44? Or are they just going to take cardboard or plastic and replicate it? That's the thing. But if they release the actual Yashica 44, that to me could be pretty impressive.
But the cost to, even if it's an already engineered device, but to take it all apart, cast all the metal pieces or have them machined in some way, the cost to do that is insurmountable.
Yeah, I don't see them doing that.
It's absolutely massive. Especially, what would the cost of a used Yashica 44 run you on eBay at this point in the game?
I haven't looked for a while, but they're not cheap because they're good cameras. But the problem is with that is that it's a, you know, you need to know, you just can't slap a roll of 35 millimeter or 120 in it. It's a specific camera, but it is a cult camera. And I would suspect that it's fairly pricey. So I cannot believe that they would retool it and make a metal camera just like this. So if they do, good on them, but it's going to be super expensive. But if they just make some cheap plastic knockoff, that would be disappointing.
If it's going to be super expensive and you're mm-hmm. giving somebody money with a track record of mm-hmm. taking a lot of money and making something super cheap, mm-hmm. Just go to when the Yashica brand was great and buy a used one, because then you're going to be guaranteed that the money that you're throwing at this thing mm-hmm. is actually going to give you a camera that's tried and tested.
Yeah, I mean, you could get a Matt 124. You could get an MG1. There's Yashica. The cameras that are out there are amazing.
I don't know. So here's the sad part of all this. They've passed their funding goal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But just just for the film.
Yes. Well, and I think the MF1 is listed in the same Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, but I think they would throw those in for free. They're so cheap.
Yeah, pretty well. I mean, you are paying for them, though. They're not in every package. So this is for their film. The prices I'm seeing are in Canadian dollars because it translated that for me. They were trying to get 100,000 Hong Kong dollars, mm-hmm. And they're at 113 Hong Kong dollars, which in Canadian dollars, they're at just under $20,000 Canadian. Right. And if that's what it costs to basically buy old stock mm-hmm. or re-spool stuff, and not make a mess of it, well, at least that's a place to start. Crawl your way back, right?
Yeah, I saw the same thing. When I looked at the Kickstarter and it was like less than $15,000, that gave me the impression that they're making a purchase of inventory that's already out there.
Right.
And it's just their initial purchase. So, I don't know. They really burn themselves with their first Kickstarter. So it'll be interesting to see how it rolls out. I'm not positive that it will be positive, but, you know, fingers crossed.
It's almost better that somebody just comes up with a brand new name and starts putting out new product, because mm-hmm. you don't have any baggage behind you. And yes, there was a pedigree, mm-hmm. But you've already sullied that. So if you want to do this and you want to move forward, you can do something like Cat Labs is doing,
right.
Which is a related story. So they have a film, a black and white emulsion that is 80 ISO and super fine grain. They claim most of the stuff around that mm-hmm. ISO is going to be a very fine grained film. And you can get it in 120 format. And almost at the time that we're recording this, within a week, it will be available in 4x5 and 8x10 sheet film by mid-May. And that is wonderful.
Right.
Especially because they said, you know, we're not even going to aim for 35 millimeter until 2020. I mean, they're serious about the larger format systems. And this is a brand new emulsion mm-hmm. that they are coming out with. I'm not sure if you've dug anything deeper than what I'm seeing in the article, but it does look like the film has, it's fairly low contrast. And so mm-hmm. you could always push that afterwards if you wanted to. You've got that option. But it seems like it's a high quality film.
Yeah, I like it. Cat Labs has been around for a while. They've got a physical store out on the East Coast of the U.S. And, you know, they were I think he's probably the owner, or at least somebody that was one of the managing partners of the company, was at Photokina last year and talked about some things they were doing. So it's a legit company. And it's primarily focused on large format, medium format film photography. And so it's more of what I would call a specialty house. So they're in the business today. And my guess is that this is going to be a very specialty type of film. So it's for people who know what they're doing. So if something that low ISO, you just don't slap that in your cheap 120 film Holga.
You got to have a fast lens, or you're on a tripod and you're doing something architectural, right?
Right. Or you know how to push, and then you take it and you're going to, in the darkroom, you either adjust the contrast or you adjust the contrast in post editing after you scan the film. So this is for people who know what they're doing. I think that it's probably more geared to people who are doing sheet film. So the you know, the medium to large format camera users. Mm-hmm. I think that their focus on 120 and sheet film is probably smart, knowing that their background. There's a lot of black and white 35 millimeter film out there. So I do like the fact that they're focusing on the other side of the genre, which is what their strong suit is. And so I'm pretty positive on this. And the film is affordable. And like you
what
said,
what happened? Sorry to cut you off, Steve, but I just jumped into my head. There was a Russian company developing a number of black and white film emulsions that I haven't heard from in ages, and I backed them on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I did too. Silbera.
Yes, that's right.
They still produce film, so they have film that's available, but they're still having some issues. My understanding, there's some logistic issues in Europe with their new products they're introducing. But and of course, anytime you do a Kickstarter and you don't complete it exactly like you say, where there's delay, you know, the social media and the blogosphere just blows up about how corrupt it is and how they've screwed us all over. But those type of things take time. So I'm still pretty positive on that company. And they do have an active store, active presence of selling things. It's just their Kickstarter is not come through. And I don't think that was Kickstarter. I think that was Indiegogo or something similar.
Right. That's a platform that I've used before as well.
Yeah. So yes, this one appears to be a little bit more measured. They've already got the film available. I've seen it out in the market.
It's not a crowdfunding campaign, we should say.
No.
It's you buy it and it ships to you.
Correct. Correct. And again, it's a specialty type of film. So yeah, I'm quite interested in it. I'll probably buy a couple packs to see how it plays out and compare it against some other things. But again, and the thing is, it's not for the casual shooter. It's for somebody who knows what they're doing.
But it's also $5.55 a roll.
Right.
So even if you are a casual shooter and you just want to experiment and you're not expecting to get amazing results, you just want to see what this experience is and learn from it, then
it's good price.
If you've got that camera and you've got some way to develop the film, preferably yourself, because it's much less expensive that way, then that's a $5 bit of entertainment for yourself.
Right, right. So yeah, I think it's a good thing. It's that's one that you can probably count on. That'll be probably a pretty good film.
Right. Very cool.
Pretty excited about that one.
Let's go on to the kind of opposite side of things here, and let's take a look at photography in the modern era. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happened since antiquities in terms of editing images. I mean, Stalin was known to remove people standing next to him if they happened to disappear in reality from images that were taken. But I think it gets called out much more frequently these days, and I'm glad for that.
Right.
That people can't simply pass off an image edit as reality. And
right.
So we've got two such occurrences that have come up this week. A Milky Way photograph that was published by National Geographic is raising eyebrows, says this Petapixel article. And so the article from National Geographic is titled "See Through the World's Oldest Trees by Starlight." It was published on April 26th by the National Geographic science staff writer Catherine Zuckerman, and features photos by Beth Moon. Work on part of a project that was titled Diamond Nights, where you've got these beautiful old trees. These are trees in Namibia, I believe. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of the exact location, but they look iconic, and I think I've seen very similar locations before with the night sky above. And a beautiful series of images, I might say. But it doesn't take a lot to start seeing repeating patterns in the Milky Way. And I don't know if I'm on the autism spectrum at all, but I'll notice like noise patterns that have been cloned in images. And I'm like, yeah, somebody cloned something out of there immediately. And it just jumps right out at me. I see these patterns. So when I looked at this photo of the Milky Way, I saw this exact same pattern multiple times, four or five times across the sky, even before I had noticed that it was, pointed out very specifically with red circles. And so I see that. And I think, okay, clearly some trickery is going on here. So, I mean, what does this story mean to you, Steve?
It's troubling. The thing that's funny is that I did like you. When I saw the original image, I immediately thought, there's a repeating pattern in there. And if it's something as random as the universe, that immediately set off warning signs for me. But the thing that bothers me is that a publication like National Geographic wouldn't catch that. And yeah, that it's published. Now, they can say, well, hey, we made a mistake. We can go back. But the thing is that it got through their filters. And that's right, National Geographic.
Automated, right? There has to be software out there, even if you have to write it yourself as National Geographic to have something proprietary that can analyze an image for repeating patterns and say, okay, this image has been doctored in a way that is unbefitting of us to publish.
Right. There's two concerns that it raises for me. Number one is that if you look at publications, newspapers primarily, they're getting rid of a lot of their staff photographers and going with more of the citizen journalists, the citizen photographers for their images. And so there's that professionalism that to a certain extent is going away. And so we're going to be fed more and more of these images that could be doctored, they could be altered, that, you know, you may not, the casual person may not see it. So it seems to be getting more and more potential that we get, you know, the quote unquote fake news, but in images. And so that's bothering me, because even if the publication reverses themselves in the future and says, hey, we're sorry, we put out an image that was doctored, it's already out there.
I'm looking at it now, and I don't know if I'm just going overboard, but I'm starting to see more repeating patterns, not just that one that was first identified. The longer I stare at it, the more I see similarities that are just completely unnatural.
I know.
Somewhere in the comments, it was an earlier comment that they specifically said, you know, it's great, a great image. Here it is from Adrien Louis Maudoui. Reposted by Jay McLeod, says, not only this, but could you please explain how you got the quiver trees of Namibia with a northern hemisphere Milky Way in the background? The Milky Way can never be seen like that in the southern hemisphere at any time of the year. Now, I'm not going to fact check that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say there's a lot up with these images to begin with, right, and that could possibly be true. So, yeah, and the fact that something like that, if you have any astronomer take a look at these images, you have to, even if you're just using an expert to vet the content. You know, when I created a number of coins for the Royal Canadian Mint that featured snowflakes, which, you know, is still something that I'm very proud of doing, even though I could be considered something of an expert in that field, they sent those designs to atmospheric scientists to just confirm with somebody with a PhD that these are actually snowflakes, or that they're indicative of what an actual snowflake could be.
Yeah, but that raises the second issue that really concerns me, is that as technology becomes more and more impressive and Photoshop or equivalent type of things become more and more powerful, it's easier to fake these things. So if you have something like the night sky, you've got people that can look at that and say, oh, I see something immediately wrong with that. Like I said, I'm not a professional astronomer, and I've picked that out almost immediately. So, but think about a crisis scene, or think about a political scene that's put in your local newspaper and it's been doctored. You may not know that.
Exactly. And there might be no way to prove one way or another, because it's all hearsay. Right.
And people could say, you know, this has been going on forever, you know, dodging and burning in the dark room, or, you know, it's been happening forever. But the thing is the technology is becoming so good that it's going to be harder and harder for the casual observer to know what's true and what's not true. So this disturbed me a little bit, because as a photographer and as somebody who edits images and is in the beauty world and the social media world, I don't like this.
Well, and you also have to take a look at the Barbie face of Kazakhstan's new leader, which was also in the news here, as a perfect example of, yes, you can doctor something, but when multiple news agencies from multiple countries are taking almost identical pictures, if you heavily smooth out somebody's skin, and somebody else is taking a nearly identical photograph less than 2 feet from beside you, and they're compared, you're going to be caught immediately at this.
Yes.
It's this I like to laugh at, because they were caught so easily and repeatedly, and it just looks silly when you compare these things side by side. And it honestly, it makes the Kazakhstan leader or whoever in his government that decided to do this, the entire organization, look a little bit less powerful than had they not done anything at all.
Yeah, clearly that's amateur hour. You know, it's at a different level versus the Nat Geo publication image. But I think the thing with this is that people have to understand this has been going on forever in the beauty world, in the fashion world, in the influencer world. Images are edited constantly, but that's accepted. But on something like the president of a country, I mean, come on, seriously.
I remember when U.S. President Trump was, elected to office. Shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. he gave directives as to how he should be photographed.
Oh, sure.
So that people wouldn't see any double chin, mm-hmm. Or something like that. And the Barbra Streisand effect came in full on the internet.
Yeah, you can't do that.
And older pictures of Trump before this edict mm-hmm. were shared ad nauseum with that double chin grossly accentuated in Photoshop mm-hmm. because that's what the internet does, right?
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's look, at the end of the day, photo editing in the beauty, fashion, portrait world is to take what you've got and just improve it. It's not to alter it. It's not to change it. So if you give somebody a digital diet or you take away a mole or you take away a double chin, that's manipulation and that's fake and it shouldn't happen. But it happens. You look at Instagram, you look at Snapchat, you look at the filters people use. And they get addicted to that stuff. But when it's a 14-year-old girl or a 15-year-old guy versus the president of a country, a little different.
It's a little different. And, you know, I've used some of some tools in Photoshop, like the Liquify tool that's right. usually used for, retouching portraits and what right. have you. I've used it to, like, bend the stem of a flower to just uh-huh. have a slight curve to it.
Right.
Could I have done that in reality? Mm-hmm. Yep. Probably.
Sure.
And it would have looked exactly the same. But here I am in post-processing to get it to bend that way, which would be an easier thing. Am I doctoring an image at that point? Yep. But mm-hmm. I'm not creating them for photojournalistic purposes. And I don't think that I'm bending reality so much that it's untruthful.
No, you're taking something and you're enhancing it, but you're not selling it as something that, you know, hey, this is real life. This is the way it really is. Or this is what somebody looks like. I think that it just shows that, you know, the ability exists that we can make changes to things, and those abilities to change things are becoming better and better. And that's what scares me. And at the same time, in my profession as an agent for a modeling company or a modeling agency, I don't want to see somebody that looks so different that when you see them in real life, or when I put somebody out for a photographer to work with and they look different than what they look like in their images, that makes me look bad. So at the end of the day, I like to see what it's really like.
I completely agree.
Right.
All right. Let's move on to our next story. This one, it affects a good chunk of the U.S. that wants to buy camera gear mm-hmm. because over the last few years, just shy of a year ago, the article says that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that out-of-state retailers mm-hmm. are required to collect sales tax on internet sales,
right.
Says this article from DP Review, titled B&H Effectively Cancels Out Internet Sales Tax in the U.S. with its own PayBoo credit card, PayBoo. Almost sounds like a spelling error. Okay, so they've got this PayBoo credit card
right.
that it's not branded as Visa or MasterCard or anything else,
right.
As you can get from certain retailers that have a partnership with those vendors. It looks to be exclusively for B&H,
right,
and they're handling a lot of the back end stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing here is they're charging you the sales tax, but then they're immediately giving you a credit on the card to right. the penny of what that sales tax was, which is a bold move. So, I mean, you're effectively paying the government. The government gets their sales tax mm-hmm. money out of that. That's not changing. But you're now getting a credit to the B&H organization for that amount to spend on future purchases.
Right.
Brilliant, risky, a bit of both. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I think actually it's a discount from the actual invoice. So you actually, what happens is that you, let's say you have a $1,000 purchase and it's a 10% sales tax. So you're going to pay, you know, $1,100. But what they do is that on that invoice, you're charged the tax, but they discount product by $100. So you're actually just paying it as if it were tax-free. So it's not future, it's immediate.
Right. Forgive my confusion on that, because there's been a number of articles that I've been reading about this. But
at least
regardless
that's the way
of how it is, that they're canceling this out.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting is that a couple of things that concern me about this. First of all, there could be some confusion, because you're right. It's a revolving credit card, but it's just for B&H. So if you were to take this PayBu card into your local CVS and buy some sodas, it won't, you know, you can't use it. Secondly, is that the interest rate that most credit cards charge is, let's say, up to 18%. The APR on this credit card is 30%.
Yeah.
And so if you're running a balance, because it is a revolving card, you know, it can end up costing you a lot more than what you think. The other thing then, for local retailers, one of the things that I try to do is I always try to support my local retailer. But it's very tempting on high volume purchases or high value purchases to look at it. Okay, now I've seen it, I felt it. Now I go to a company like B&H and I buy it online because I didn't have to pay taxes.
Right.
But that competitive advantage went away, but now they potentially have it again.
I found the language, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so I'll read directly from their frequently asked questions list here on how it really works. Mm-hmm. And it says, when you use the PayBu credit card to pay for purchases made in our superstore or shipped to eligible states, mm-hmm. B&H will charge the total of the merchandise plus applicable taxes and fees, mm-hmm. but will instantly issue and apply a reward at checkout.
Right.
So they do technically have to charge you the full amount.
Right.
And then they issue that reward. Now, they don't say exactly what that is. I'm assuming it would be a credit onto
credit,
the card.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And that's where my sense of confusion was there. Thus, the benefit will be automatically applied and the PayBu card will only be charged the net amount.
It's confusing, because I think a lot of times, you know, like these type of cards that are sponsored by the companies, I think there's the potential that it could be, you know, people could get confused by that. Secondly, is that I wonder what Visa and MasterCard and American Express are going to say about something like this, because they do have, you know, other cards have like a cash back type of program, but it's for any purchases. This is specific. So it's only for B&H, and it's only, so if you go and use your Visa card, you don't get that. You may get cash back, but it would be not as much as this. So I'm sure B&H has some pretty smart lawyers and some tax guys that have looked this through, and it's probably a good deal.
They are effectively absorbing that tax.
Yeah, they're taking
the
hit.
We have a harmonized sales tax here. And if I were to buy anything at my local camera stores, it's 13%.
Right.
And if I buy from B&H, the duty that I have to pay when it crosses the border is about equal to that. I mean, that's not going to change for me here as a Canadian, because I can't get one of these cards, at least not yet. But they're effectively absorbing that amount of profit on every sale. And especially some of the higher value items, like a brand new flagship camera, the margins on that aren't high, I don't think. Right. But then they have to absorb, some states might not have high numbers of tax. Others might have even higher than me. And they have to just say, okay, we're going to take that hit. But they are going to make some back in certain ways, because they're not going to have to pay Visa or MasterCard. They're 2 or 3% for that transaction. So there is a part of it. And then the rest comes from people letting a balance sit on a 30% interest card, which they figure, I'm assuming they figure, will cover up that difference.
Yeah, but they don't get that. That goes through a bank. So this is a bank-supported card. It's with a bank called Synchronicity, I think it's called. So it is a bank-issued card. It's just specific to B&H.
Interesting.
And so what will happen then is that the bank gets that fee. So I do think there'd be a merchant fee that B&H is charged. My guess is that there's more than likely some sort of a sharing because the APR is so high that more than likely they're sharing with B&H. But again, I'm just speculating. I used to be in this industry, so I kind of know the way it works behind the scenes. So I do think that it's a bold move by B&H. I think it's a way for them to give back. But the thing is, kind of sad for me is that one of the excluded states is my home state. So even if I, and I do buy from B&H online, I wouldn't be able to use this card. So that's too bad for me.
Yeah, and too bad for me up here in Canada.
Yeah. But no, I do think it's a bold move, and I applaud them for trying something like this. It's clearly it's a cost to them, but it's a way possibly to pick up some sales that maybe they were missing once these tax laws changed, but good on them.
How much do you think this is going to hurt the smaller, more independent camera stores if they're still in business?
None. I mean, look, I have a fairly good camera store here in Indianapolis called Roberts Camera, and they have a very, very good business model. And it's primarily based on support and having things in store and a good customer service. For somebody like me who knows photography, it's just as easy for me to go to their store and buy it versus going to B&H. The difference is if I want it today, I'm going to get it today, and it's going to be in stock versus having it shipped to me. So there's a trade-off, but I don't think at a place like a camera store, most people that go to a local camera store probably haven't even heard of B&H. So it's the higher end professionals or the people who buy on a regular basis that are aware of B&H. So I think it's to an exclusive clientele that probably had been going to their local camera store or going to Amazon or something. They may pick up business there.
Well, the industry is changing. There's mm-hmm. no question.
Oh, yeah.
From photojournalistic integrity to the way we actually buy our
equipment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of leads into the next story here, where Canon, mm-hmm. This is reported by F-Stoppers, Canon's dramatic drop in sales is mm-hmm. a sign of something much more ominous for photographers. I'm not sure if you had a chance to dig through this article and what it really means, I think, for photography moving forward, especially as most of the big brands, Canon, Nikon, and Panasonic, not to leave out Fuji with their medium format mm-hmm. that is still getting its legs, they have new platforms. And mm-hmm. so people that might have brand affinity to any of these names, well, all of their new hardware coming out, are you going to jump onto the next thing, or are you going to read the reviews and wait a while and see what everything else turns into from the competitors? Which, you know, if you're jumping into a new system, brand loyalty doesn't necessarily mean as much.
No.
To quote from the article, the one sentence with some fun numbers is the Japanese giant just revealed that the sales of their DSLR and MILC cameras, that's their mirrorless interchangeable lens cameras, mm-hmm. Have fallen by almost 20% in the first quarter of 2019, prompting them to reduce their sales forecast for the year by over 14%. That's a big hit, right?
Big number. Yeah, I mean, bottom line is the way I looked at this, and I've followed this industry, followed Nikon, followed Canon, Fuji, Sony for quite a while. And what I've found is that, first of all, there will always be changes in the industry. Change in this industry is constant. New cameras, new companies, new film stock, new technologies. So there's always going to be change. Secondly, is that cameras aren't going to go away. So we're not going to wake up one day and say, oh my gosh, we can't buy a professional DSLR or a professional camera to do our jobs. Or we're not going to be able to buy a little point and shoot because we're a casual shooter. Third is that professional photographers aren't going to go away. So, right. You know, it could be gloom and doom. Oh my gosh, Canon's not releasing their new camera. Well, there's going to be other cameras that a professional photographer can use. And third and fourth is that the challenge with some of the big camera companies is that they lock you in. So like I'm a Nikon shooter because I started with Nikon.
Yeah.
And I've invested in lenses. I've invested in equipment. And so, you know, do I want to go to, let's say, a Pentax medium format or a Fujifilm medium format? Yes, I'd love to do something like that. But I've invested in all this camera equipment, I mean, all these lenses. So to a certain extent, the camera companies haven't adapted, I don't think, as the big ones haven't adapted as much as they probably should have. But bottom line is that I'm convinced that changes like this are good. Maybe it's time to shake up a company like Canon, you know, or Nikon, and for a smaller company that has some new technology to come out. But as a professional photographer myself, the fact that if Nikon suddenly goes away, okay, they go away. But there's other alternatives out there. Or their sales drop and they don't put as much effort into developing new cameras. Okay, you know, my DSLR works fine. You know, I love the images I get out of it.
Your clients aren't clamoring for 100 megapixel images, otherwise they're not going to hire you sort of thing, right?
No, I mean, the thing is what people have to understand is that the casual photographer, somebody who goes and posts pictures on social media, is an influencer, shares images of their vacation, they're not going to haul around a big DSLR. And if they do, they're spending a lot of time behind the scenes. They're going to take a picture with their cell phone, which is a great camera, or a small, you know, micro four thirds camera that has a Wi-Fi connection to it and they can upload it right to their phone. That's what the casual photographer is doing. The professional photographer, honestly, will always have kit to use.
Right. Do you think that that brands like Canon are sort of devaluing their brand equity in some ways? When another story that I found this week is that Canon has removed that central pin in the hot shoe of their least expensive cameras that basically makes it incompatible with cheap or other brand manual flashes. How many people are actually going to be using on these cameras? I mean, there's a fuss that's being made about this now, but they need to find a way to make these particular cameras less expensive. Mm-hmm. And if shaving a couple of pennies here and there improves their profit margins to actually be able to produce these products, I don't want to hold that against them. But at the same time, you look at what their high-end offerings are, and whatever the successor to the 5D series and the 1D series is going to be, they have been completely silent about that. Right. And we're just seeing more and more of this low-end stuff come out, where a photographer wanting to jump into a platform, like climbing a ladder, you're going to start somewhere. You want to see how high you can get within this platform. And the high end is just maybe not theirs anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think the challenge is that for a smaller camera, a more entry-level camera, when you take away a pin like that, you're locking people into your equipment. And if for somebody who's going to use a flash, they're going to buy something on Amazon, they're going to buy a Yongno, or they're going to buy a third-party type flash, they're not necessarily going to spend the money for a higher-end Canon flash. Now you've just basically told them you can't use that lower-end third-party. But then you also think with somebody like me, I couldn't use it because I use triggers on all my cameras. So I'm a studio photographer. So if I wanted a low-end Canon camera that I could use just for some behind-the-scenes shots, I couldn't because I can't fire my lights with it now. So,
but again, that you're not the audience for that particular camera.
No.
And so somebody buying an entry level digital SLR wants the tactile control that they offer and the larger sensor size than a cell phone would offer, and some potential to grow with that particular product. And you're going to weigh your options. You're going to see, okay, well, how much can I grow with this versus that, you know, brand A versus brand B. And if you're coming in at the very low end, then maybe those few cents that you're saving right there is actually costing you more sales than it's worth.
Yeah. I don't know how this is going to play out, but I think the casual photographer, they're going to go into their camera store and they're going to buy basically what they're recommended or what might be there.
Yeah, they're going to go to this level of minutia on the product specs to say, hey, where this pin is missing over here. Right. It took some experts some people that, really dig into these details to find these particular problems.
Yeah. I look at that and I think, okay, that's as a professional photographer, that's disappointing. They're locking you in. Now it limits me to use that camera. But, you know, the casual photographer is going to use their cell phone or their inexpensive point and shoot, or they're going to go to Costco or an equivalent type of store and get whatever is the cheapest camera that's there that's in a box. It includes two lenses and a camera bag and two, SD cards as well. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to go in there and say, hey, look, it's missing a pin, so I can't use my flash. Most people don't use a flash on a camera anyway. So, if it's a money-saving thing for them, that's great. I think it gets back to a bigger issue, though, is do we need another camera from a major manufacturer that probably, what difference is it? I mean, is it worth a new camera? Could they be putting their money into something else? I don't know.
Well, when you go to those low-end cameras, it seems like their release cycle is so much faster than the cameras that me and you use. Where, you know, if I've got a camera and I use it for 3 to 5 years, that's good. And then it's still probably better than I need based on what my clients are asking for, unless I've got some fairly unusual and specific requests. Like I bought an external video recorder recently because I had a client that specifically asked for even higher quality than the camera could use or could record internally.
Right.
And so I augmented myself.
Sure.
You know, I had a way to enhance and to get paid for that particular project. But that's like the 1% of my clientele that are going to ask me for something obscure like that. And if I say no, well, then I still have the 99% of my other work and I don't even have to go down that road. They can find somebody else.
Yeah, it was a curious article. I read it and I thought about it from my perspective. If I were a photographer, you know, that kind of limits my use of a camera like that. I look at it from the standpoint of, are they saving money? How much money would they save? You know, it's just, it's a curious decision they've made. And it sounds like it's just simply for to save money so they can lower the price or increase their profits. And bottom line is, the question that I still have is, do we need another camera like that?
Yep. Yeah. Do you need to put them out every year?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Can that camera follow the same release cycle as everybody else, right? Can you put one out every 3 years?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to talk to a like a camera store or somebody who is actually selling those to see if something like that is important to them versus somebody like ourselves, which are professional photographers that notice that little minutia. And they may say, hey, look, having a camera like that every year is important for our sales cycle. You know, there's people that come in, they want the newest and the greatest. And if we can now sell it for slightly cheaper, that's better for them. So who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? But woe on those people with a Canon SL3 or the, it's called by a number of names, the EOS 200D Mark II, the KISS X10 if you're in Japan. You can't fire a manual or third-party flash or a wireless trigger. Find some other way to do it. Spend the money on the Canon flash that costs as much as your camera body does in order for you to have compatibility. All right, let's move on to the picks of the week. And so this week I was digging through my archives because I'm getting ready to print a book on macro photography. And Steve, I made you privy to the decisions I was making in terms of the cover the other day, which I'll be announcing within the next couple of weeks. I've got a prototype book just as sort of mostly empty pages on the way with a few nice spreads because I'm not going to write the entire book until I can, you know, make sure that I've got the funds to actually have it printed. But at least I'll have something to demonstrate what will look like as a finished product. And so I was thinking about companies that I've used in the past for printing and producing material. I like to have stuff that is showy and presentable. I've got some fancy business cards. My previous book that I had done had like a nice spot gloss on the hardcover, which was beautiful. And I've used a company out of the U.S. that I think they're based out of Illinois. They diamond die and bevel cutting. And I'd originally approached them because I was making some really fancy and obscure 3D stereo cards for those antique stereoscopes that you might have seen in museums, or maybe you've got one stuck in a drawer somewhere that you inherited. And you can get them cheaply on eBay for, I don't know, 30 bucks or so. But I figured, hey, you know, I'm experimenting with 3D. Let's just do this up to the nines. And they made these beautifully cut out cards that have an incredibly narrow frame on them, absolutely perfectly. And I also had some embossing done on them just to add a little bit of extra class to it. And no matter how difficult the task is that I gave them, they said, sure, no problem. I had them print up some greeting cards that have one of my freezing soap bubbles on the front that is embossed. So the crystal structure actually sticks out on the card itself, which is really fun to see.
Nice.
And there's some paper that's placed inside so that you can write on both sides without having to write on the wrinkly, rippled paper stuff.
Right.
But the cost to do this is not insurmountable. There's a lot of companies that are in the die cutting business to do exactly this kind of stuff. And if you're willing to pay a couple of $100 as the overhead for production, because that they have to make the dies and you've got to pay for that before they actually start to do it, the return on your investment for something like that is huge. Mm-hmm. It's going to make a huge difference in terms of how people look at the finished product if you're trying to do a bunch of greeting cards, Christmas cards, whatever it happens to be. And I just had a company recently, a local, I think it was a law firm. They asked me for the rights to print one of my images on a Christmas card. Mm-hmm. And it was the same image that I had my own cards done. And I already had those dies made. So I just did another run of those cards from there the same manufacturer. Uh-huh. And so then there was more profit for me for that. But my point is, Diamond Die and Bevel, the link will be in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. They've done an amazing job with me as a client. And so it's just a shout out to them that if anybody wants some weird extra little accent onto, say you're making some framed prints for a gallery, mm-hmm. and you want your name sort of written like on like a glass block, if I could speak, a gloss black on the edge of the frame that's already like a charcoal type of matte mm-hmm. around it, just to make it look really nice and high end, they'll do that for you. And that little extra accent, you know, helps you stand out amongst Absolutely. Everybody else. And you need to have that today to stand out.
I agree. I think it's a great pick. You know, I looked through the company and I thought, wow, now I'm going to try to figure out how I can use something like this, you know, for my agency. It's really nice. And I wouldn't even have known how to do anything like this or ever either research a company. So yeah, I think how do you stand out in a crowd? It's a good pick.
Affordable, and I've been happy with everything they've done for me. So perfect. Thanks for agreeing that was a good pick, Steve. And I'm curious, you sent me two that you might be picking one or the other of. What have you decided on?
Yeah. You know, since we talked about film photography, a lot of times if you're in the digital world, you take a picture and you connect it to your phone and it's uploaded. But if you're doing film, there's a workflow associated with it. And one of those workflows is that you can do it at home. And the thing is about film photography is that it's more tactile. You're more actively involved with it. And so one of the things about film photography, which is a challenge, is it has to be developed. You take a picture, you have to take that film, you have to take it to a store, and you have to get it developed. Well, one of the ways to do it also is to do it at home. And so you need to develop the film. So what I'm going to recommend is not a specific product, but kind of a genre. And that is, you can buy kits that you can buy from places like B&H, which we've talked to, your local camera store, like I have, or online. And these are called press kits. So for film that's color, you need a specific chemistry. It's called C41 for like the new film from Kodak, the slide film that's just been reintroduced, Ektachrome, you need E6.
And these are standards, right?
Standards.
So any color negative film is pretty much guaranteed today to be C41.
C41. So if it's,
and any reversal film, any slide film is E6.
Correct. So if you buy the Yashica film, which is C41 that we talked about earlier, you have to get it developed, and it's developed in C41. Well, so if you want to do it at home, you can buy kits. And once you make the initial investment of a way to get the film onto a spool, the spools, the developing tank, which isn't that expensive, but once you make that investment.
How much does a daylight development tank like that cost?
The tank, you can get a good double roll of a tank that's going to be under $30 US.
Okay, so marginal investment there.
Marginal. You're going to need some mixing bowls, but you can get those at your local store. You're going to need probably something to measure out, but the investment is fairly affordable. But once you make that initial investment, you don't need anything else. But what you do need is you need the chemistry. And the chemistry is not that expensive. So this one kit that I just bought, because of my chemistry is expired, the C41 kit is only approximately $30 US.
And how many rolls of film could you process with that?
You can easily do up to 20. I would say that if you develop them all at once or within the course of, let's say, 30 days, you can probably get between 18 to 20. If you're like me and I'm high volume, you can do more. But the problem is the chemistry kind of wears out. So for between 15 to 20 rolls, you can, with $30, you can develop those rolls.
So that's less than $1.50 a roll.
Right. So if you take it into a store, you're going to pay anywhere from $5 to $10 to get that that film developed. So the thing is that this is a way, this is a Unicolor kit, which is one of the standard companies. You can get these from B&H, you can get it from Freestyle, you can buy it from Amazon. You can do it at home. So I'll give you the links to a couple of companies that offer these type of products. So what I want to say, it's a lot like when I said earlier on my bike ride, is that if you want to do film, don't let the fact that, you know, developing hold you back. Take those pictures, take them to your store. But if you want to do it at home, there's a way to do it. And it's fairly easy. Once you learn how to do it, it takes less than a half an hour.
You have to get the temperatures right, but that's not a very tricky thing to do. And if you look online, like how do you get the proper temperatures for C41 chemistry? So many people have MacGyvered really clever ways to get it just perfect with minimal effort.
Or you just use hot water and you put your chemistry in hot water.
Well, pretty much, right? Yeah. And even if you're off a little bit, it's still going to work.
It's going to work.
It doesn't have to be like exactly to the tenth of a degree in order for it to be accurate.
Right.
And I think a lot of people think, I have to measure and I've got to have these thermometers and if I'm not fast enough, and just give yourself the wiggle room. Yeah. I mean, you're shooting film anyway for the experience. Make the processing part of that experience as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Like I said, it's not for everyone. It's a workflow. It's something, though, that if you want a complete workflow from taking the photograph to getting it into the computer to share it, and you want that entire workflow and you don't want it to be digital, there's a way to do that at home. And you can do it in your kitchen. You can do it in your bathroom. You just any place you need a sink, you can do it.
All right. Well, that's a fairly inexpensive rabbit hole to go down if you do this, you will gain a lot of knowledge that is probably not translatable to many other things,
right?
But it will have it'll give you a greater appreciation of the bygone era of photography if you've never tried to shoot or develop your own film. And I think that level of, I've done it, black and white can be even trickier because now you've got all different developers and different films and they are compatible, but you've got to adjust your timings and everything else.
Yes.
Where this is much more standardized.
Yeah. But it's still very easy.
It's still part of the experience where you are lending your hand to the craft. It's tangible. Mm. And we don't have a lot of tangibility in photography today. And even if you're not doing it for your professional work, if it's not your everyday thing, just to do it once in a while or to do it just once. I think would have a measurable impact on your appreciation of photography. So it's a great pick.
I agree. And, you know, film photography is you've got to enjoy it. It's a bit of a workflow, but if you're into it, you're going to find out there's a huge community. It's a lot of fun. And now you can do it at home.
And where can people find your work, Steve?
The best way to do it is just go on my portfolio site. It's Stephen Brokaw Photography. And I have my film on Film Photography Lust.
And we will have those links in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, as well as all the social media places.
Right.
You can go back through and see all of the photos that Steve posted on his trip across America on Twitter and bug him about some of the details there if you'd like. And I'm sure you'd be open if anybody had questions about film processing, if they drop you a line.
Oh, definitely.
Help them out, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Perfect. Well, thanks for being here again, Steve. On that note, if you do want to go shoot film, now is the time to get out and shoot.